Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table,
a new United Methodist community of faith located in Sacramento, California.
We hope our podcast will help those who listen to grow in faith.
The podcasts currently feature the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Duhirsu,
with a musical introduction by Anthony Coleman, our director of music.
We hope you find them inspiring.
We began this series a few weeks ago with a reflection on the meaning and the significance of Lent and what Jesus' experience in the wilderness for those 40 days meant both to Jesus and to the people around him, and how it prepared him for the temptation that he experienced after that time. And then we moved for a week and we looked together at how various followers of Jesus have understood the significance of the cross throughout history. And if you listen to people around you, you might think that there's only one way to think about the cross. One of the things that we reflected on is just how many different ways people of faith, followers of Jesus, have tried to make sense of what the cross means in their life. And if you're interested in listening to those, we keep those online and you can hear what was said and what was shared during that morning and wonder about it for yourself. Then last week we gathered around the story of the Samaritan woman at the well. And we remembered how Jesus both knew her and loved her in that space, reflected on what that might mean in our own lives to be both known and to be loved. And this morning, preachers around the world had some anxiety because they looked at the lectionary, the text, the cycle that we all or many of us use to help guide us in worship. It's a three-year cycle, and this one said John 9. And you open John 9, and it keeps going. And going. Some of our kitchen table leaders are recognizing this. It keeps going and going and going and going and going and going. And so we've decided, last week we used video to express the scripture passage in that way. We're going to try something different this week. We're going to go back and forth. Linda's going to read a little bit. You all are going to be involved in the scripture as well with a response that we've taken from a Methodist pastor named Steve Garness Holmes. And we're going to weave a song that'll be very, very familiar to almost all of us throughout this as well. And so we invite you to actually just take out a Bible if you have one in front of you and to just look through John 9. There are, if you brought your own, excellent. There are also Bibles in the pews. Just look through John 9 and read it a little bit, but you'll just remain seated for all of the music and for all of the words that we share. And just turn to John 9 whenever you feel led, or if you feel just to close your eyes and be present in the music, make this space your own. To hear, it tells the story of one person, and then it also tells the story of a lot of people around him who get caught up in trying to figure out how this healing that happens to him, what's the cause of it, and is it okay that this person was healed, or is it not? The passage that we're about to hear, you might say that it undermines simplistic understandings of sin. See, in their day, and perhaps in our day as well, actually one of the notes that I was reading this morning as I awoke was that 30% of people who have children in the United States born with disabilities acknowledge in a survey format that they wonder and they fear that they have done something wrong and God is punishing them for this disability. And so part of me wants to say this was back in Jesus' day that people equated sin and disability, But it isn't. It wasn't just back then. It lives into this day. And there was some hope that I found, because folks who had then had those children and lived with them for a few years, that it went down to 3% of the people still wondered and feared that possibility. And so there was some hope that I experienced, that in, as we get to know folks with disabilities, we recognize that this is no punishment from God or from anyone else, that this is both gift and challenge that we're all called in community to be together and to work with. In Jesus' day, they might have heard this story, though, and they might have known so well the story of Jacob and Esau, the story of these brothers who in their womb are fighting with who's going to be the first one out, who's going to be the one to receive the birthright as twins. And so when they hear this story, they could actually imagine that sin had something to do with something that happens even as early as the womb. And so Midrash would have happened, and people would have been wondering about this together. And so that's the context that we come to this story with. And in our day, we're thankful to have had theologians with disabilities who've helped us to understand, even wonder about, the possibility of God being imagined as disabled. You can picture that God who dies on a cross. You picture salvation. And you might be able to just imagine for a moment a God that isn't able-bodied, but a God who God's self is even disabled. And so we move into this story of Jesus walking with his disciples. We don't get much detail at the beginning. They simply pass a blind person, and the disciples are ready, like they always are, with their question: whose fault is that? Did that man sin, or did his parents sin? It's called theodicy. It's this question of, why do bad things happen to good people? And the disciples see this person who clearly something bad has happened to him, and they ask Jesus, why? What's happened to this? And in Jesus' day, as we know, that they would have wondered, was it the parents, like the 30% in our country, was it the parents that caused this? And this might be hard to hear, but it takes us into this category of sin, of sin. A lot of us, I think, like to think about sin as, one definition that we often get of, is missing the mark, falling short. It's about our works, how we live in the world. I actually don't think that's what John's gospel means by sin. I don't think it's even close to what John's gospel means by sin. John's gospel might actually be harder for some of us to hear, because we can put in boxes our good behavior and our bad behavior. That's not where John's gospel goes, though. See, here, sin, at its most basic, is not recognizing Jesus as God's Messiah. That's it. Sin in John's gospel, not recognizing Jesus as the Messiah, the Savior of the world. So the blindness in this case, it isn't about discerning blame. It's an occasion. It's an occasion to talk about Jesus as the Messiah. The man born blind's need, it's not his physical sight that he needs. It's a relationship with God through Jesus.
As he walked along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" And Jesus answered, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned. He was born blind so that God's works might be revealed in him." Let's say this together. God, help me see your glory. Open my eyes to your grace. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. May I see by your light. May I do the works of light. He spat on the ground, Jesus did, and made mud with the saliva and spread the mud on the man's eyes, saying to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. Then he went and washed and came back, and he was able to see. Help me let go of old ways of seeing. Give me a new consciousness. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar began to ask, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some were saying, "It is he." Others were saying, "No, it's someone like him." And he kept saying, "I am the man. Give me courage to see others as they truly are, not as I want to see them."
'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. How precious did that grace appear the hour I first believed.
One writer, Leonard Sweet, he puts it this way: Jesus had a strange sense of what was dirty and what was clean. He did not accept the boundaries that had been drawn by tradition and authority. He shared water with unacceptable Samaritans, with outcasts. And in today's gospel text, he used his own spit and plain old dirt to make a mud pie of polluted stuff that he smeared over the face of an unexpecting, unprepared, blind beggar. Gross, disgusting, dirty, unsanitary, healing, miraculous, restorative, powerful. Jesus used something common, dirt, even insulting, to transform the world of the blind man and to give him the gift of sight for the very first time. Jesus wasn't just spreading saliva and dirt around. He was spreading around God's miraculous love, the divine power of deliverance. And we all know that when that happens, when love starts to spread around, when deliverance starts to be experienced, that you better watch out. Because some people just can't handle that. Some of us just can't handle that. Sometimes all of us can't handle it, and we get in the way of it. Or maybe in spite of ourselves, we get in the way. See, in Jesus' day, we hear this story, and it's unique to John's gospel, but there are other versions in Mark and in Luke and in Matthew as well. In Mark's version of the gospel, the same thing happens. It's spit and clay. In Matthew and Luke, they avoid these details. But in John, we hear it, and it might sound like a technicality to us, mixing spit with dirt to create mud, but this is the cause of the fight. See, rule number 39 of the laws that keep the community one together says that one shall not knead on the Sabbath. And the only way to get mud out of dirt and saliva is to knead them together. And so everyone around Jesus has to answer a hard question. Is that okay? He healed this person, but to do it, he broke the laws that keep the community one together. Was that kneading okay? It feels noteworthy that Jesus was present during, up to this moment, up to the healing, and then Jesus takes off. Jesus takes off, and what ensues is a debate. A fight, an interrogation. There's really three interrogations that we're about to hear. Jesus is already long gone, nowhere to be found, and he won't return until something dramatic happens near the end of this story. And so let's continue hearing what happens with this blind man and the folks who are gathered as Jesus has left.
Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not observe the Sabbath." I confess that I sometimes care more about defending my worldview than about others and their well-being. They did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they called his parents and ask them. Give me grace to honor what is in my heart without having to ask others what I know to be true. So, for the second time, they called the man who had been blind, and they said to him, "Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner. Help me to see your grace in those whom I judge, to see your truth in what I resist, to see your presence where I have refused to see."
Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Tis grace hath brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home. The
We've moved now through two of the three interrogations. First, it was the Pharisees gathering with the man himself to say, what happened and how did it happen? And then that wasn't enough. So they go out and they seek out his parents. Was this man born blind? See, they're trying to find out, maybe he wasn't actually blind at birth. Maybe there was no miracle. Maybe we can put this Sabbath thing behind us. And we can know for certainty that there was no healing. And so we find ourselves here. I want to return to some of the words of Leonard Sweet. He writes, "The whole episode with spit, sinners, and Sabbath breaking, it was cause for accusations and censure. Not one person thought to celebrate the sightedness. Not one person congratulated the healed man. Not one person took time to gaze at the temple or feast on the sight of his parents or even to look at his own face in the mirror and to say, look at this. Not one person said, this is blue, this is a goat, or this is your mother. All the healed man got from his community was an inquisition and then an excommunication." See, we haven't quite gotten to the excommunication yet, but it's coming. It's coming very soon. This is the pattern over and over again in the Bible that we encounter through Jesus. We confront the powers that be, and then excommunication happens. And we'll see what it means in this story in just a moment. See, there's no time to celebrate. Because the folks around the man, they can't even see themselves what's happening to the man. They just wonder if their own authority is going to be questioned more deeply. And the Pharisees aren't of one mind either, let's be clear. The Pharisees themselves start to debate among themselves. Some say, see, Jesus healed this person on the Sabbath by breaking that 39th law. And in doing that, Jesus cannot be close to God. And other folks said, well, he was healed. And there was a schism. And that schism, it reflects, or maybe it echoes, the man's own neighbors. They themselves came to him and said, he is healed. This is him. And then some said, is it him? Is that really the man that was on the ground? And we don't know anything of that, do we? Division, schism. Someone says this is how it is, and someone else says, no, this is how it is. This is totally a foreign concept to all of us, only rooted in the ancient world. We can't imagine divisions like that in our day. It's no surprise. Centuries ago, this day, we get caught up in our feeling that we know with absolute certainty how it is. We don't even recognize that the it that we're talking about all comes from different perspectives. And so we get stuck. we fight with one another. One of my favorite people, I've actually just come across his writing in the last few weeks, actually. He's a New Testament scholar from Minnesota. His name is David, I want to say Lose, but maybe he'll correct me if he's listening out there. He describes it this way: the turning point of this story may be when the man born blind receives his sight. That's one way to read this story. It may also be, however, when he confesses his faith as a result of his newfound sight. So the healing that happens isn't the turning point of this story. It's him learning to share his faith through this experience. Many Christians since this story, including John Newton, the slave trader turned abolitionist and composer of the song that we've been working through, Amazing Grace, have been inspired by the man's confession. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. Could that be the turning point? Let's return to our story.
Now our response is a little longer this time. He answered, I do not know whether he is a sinner. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. Once I judged and I was blind, but by your grace I see grace, and my eyes are opened. You have set me free from the fear of seeing. You give me courage to see what is, and behold what is before me. I look with my soul, not only my eyes, and I watch what others do not notice. I look to the heart and attend to the soul, and so I see the unseen by your grace. They said, we know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from. I confess the preconceptions that blind me, the blinders of what I want to be true, and how I want to be right. The man answered, here is an astonishing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. They answered him, you were born entirely in sins, and are you trying to teach us? And they drove him out. Give me courage to see grace and mercy, to notice injustice and demeaning, even when others want me not to see, when I would be at ease being oblivious.
Yeah, when this flesh and heart shall fail, and mortal life shall cease, I shall possess within the veil a life of joy and peace.
The Pharisees, the religious leaders, they tried to intimidate this man born blind. He holds his ground and struggles with them, but they press even harder. And they intimidate based on their own status and knowledge. The story says it this way: you were born entirely in sins, and are you trying to teach us? And they drove him out. He's nothing in their worldview. He's nothing. The man, though, does not engage with these Jewish leaders, these authorities, in the categories of their expertise. Instead, he claims it for himself, and he comes back to his own real experience, something that he is the only authority of. And he responds to them, but they drive him away. And Jesus has been gone this whole time, remember? And it's when he's driven away that Jesus returns. This moment we're about to hear, Jesus finally comes back. He's missed everything, all the fighting, all the uncertainty, all the arguing. Just as a Samaritan woman is confronted by comforted by Jesus with the possibility that he is the Messiah, the story that we heard last week. Just as Jesus comes to this man who's been exiled from the community, from the temple, what some scholars say is this story then functioned in two levels. It's one to force us to answer that question of who is Jesus to us? The question they were struggling with as well. But then on the second level, the people in John's community had literally been thrown out of the synagogues themselves. They'd been thrown out because they were starting to understand Jesus as a Messiah, and there was no space for them. And so they felt excommunicated as well. And so we come back to this story, hearing it on its many, many levels. Cast out of the synagogue, this man, though, is not left alone. He's not left to fend for himself. Jesus returns at this moment in the story.
Jesus heard they had driven him out. When he found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "Who is he, sir? Tell me, so that I may believe in him." Jesus said to him, "You have seen him. The one speaking with you is he." He said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. God, help me to see with your eyes, with your compassion, with your grace, for otherwise I am blind. Jesus said, "I came into this world for judgment, so that those who do not see may see, and those who do see may become blind." Some of the Pharisees near him heard this and said to him, "Surely we are not blind, are we?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would not have sin. But now that you say we see, your sin remains. God, be my seeing. Create me anew as your eyes. Look upon this world with love from within me."
When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we'd first begun.
We want to invite you to think about this story and its echo in Amazing Grace as a story of one person growing and progressing in their faith, growing in faith as we seek to do here at the table at Central. Let's recall again this man's journey in this story. See, Jesus at first to him is just the man who healed him. That's where we begin. And then as the interrogation happens, Jesus is a prophet, he acknowledges. And then we take another step. Jesus is a miracle worker. And then as this story ends, the man born blind knows who and what he sees in Jesus, the presence of God. And with that, he seeks to worship Jesus, to turn his life towards him. It's ironic then. See, the authorities who drove him out said, "You must worship God." And so it's ironic that what he does, driven out, is worship God in the form of Jesus. It's a story of a slow progression, you might say, of faith. We try this on, and then we take another step. We grow, and we take another step, and we continue to learn to share our own stories. And so we wonder, where are you this day in your journey with Jesus? Where have you experienced some kind of healing? How has your own healing deepened your faith? How has it shaped the way that you grow in sharing that with others? The story is a story of learning, growing little by little in faith, and the ultimate celebration of this story is where we move now, Holy Communion. It's the story, this one is the particularity of one man. And in the communion story, we retrace God's movement throughout all of time and eternity to remind ourselves of God's love through Jesus for all. We move now from the particularities of that story into the depth and the mystery and the beauty of our story through the sacrament of communion. And I want to close with these words from Matthew Meyer Bolton. He wrote this for the Christian Century. The last line of the passage pulls the rug out from under any triumphal Christian interpretation of this story. Jesus warns, "But now that you say, 'We see,' your sin remains," to the Pharisees. So then the church's fundamental role is not to declare, "We see," over and against Jews or anyone else, because when we do, all that remains is our own sin. Instead, our role is to sing and to pray as humbly and doxologically as God's amazing grace allows, harmonizing for those of us that are able with former slave traders and former slaves alike. Was blind, but now I see.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. But now I'm found, was blind, but now I see.